Alan Moore is the man behind the mask worn by computer hackers and Occupy protesters the world over. But he's no typical insurgent, rather a graphic novelist. It was he who dreamt up the anarchist superhero with the ghostly bearded mask, whose face has now become perhaps the symbol for subversion. Alan Moore has in the past championed graphic novels, book-length comics, for their effect on politics and culture. Why is he now becoming disillusioned? Alan Moore, welcome to Hard Talk.
A pleasure to be here, Tim.
I described you as a writer of graphic novels, but you've said in the past that the term comics will do just as well. But these aren't comics like most people might think of them.
That's true. I mean, I suppose that in the 1980s, there were a few comic books that were actually handling more adult material, not necessarily in terms of sex or violence, but actually more intelligent ideas. And there were only a few of them, but the comics industry tended to seize upon them and come up with this catch-all phrase of graphic novels that, with the best will in the world, a load of collected Spider-Man stories is not a novel.
No, but some of the work that you have put out does sit more happily in terms of novel rather than comic. I mean, Time magazine put one of your novels, Watchmen, on its list of 100 greatest ever novels. I'm wondering whether you were proud to be made part of the canon or whether the anti-establishment bit of you was a bit cross about that.
Well, I wasn't very sure about that Time magazine poll because I believe that for a few weeks Watchmen was not only on the 100 best list, but for a few weeks it was at the top of it. I think it ended up in the top five. I can easily think of 100 great American novels that probably would have deserved to be there rather than me. But no, it was a nice thing that people thought so well of the book.
And Watchmen themselves, I mean, this is a bunch of superheroes or heroes who are not in your normal superhero mold. They're raddled, they're slightly degenerate, they're damaged individuals, aren't they? You're trying to subvert the genre.
Well, it was more a case of when we actually did Watchmen, I was trying to think what these fairly ridiculous characters would be like if they were actually existing in a real world. I mean, in the real world, we have lots of traumatised children, but very few of them go on to become bat-themed vigilantes. So I was trying to imply that if you were going to put on a costume and fight crime, it would probably be for all sorts of complex and probably unpleasant reasons.
And some of them meet fates that are sort of pathetic, aren't they? I mean, the one who gets his cape caught in the revolving door of a bank and ends up being shot by one of the armed robbers that he's trying to protect the customers against. Yeah. Again, it's a matter of subversion, isn't it?
Well, yes, and also, I mean, we took the standard Batman image, the person who is compulsively dedicated to eradicating crime. And thinking about that in the real world, it seemed that such a person would probably be a lonely, paranoid vigilante. He'd probably have terrible hygiene habits, no friends. This seemed to be a more feasible reality rather than living in a mansion and having a sumptuous bat cave.
When we talk about reality, one of your most celebrated characters has been appropriated by Occupy protesters, by computer hackers across the world. This is the image from your book V for Vendetta back in the 1980s. This is a superhero who's an anarchist terrorist trying to fight the forces of fascism and repression. Is this character a hero for you?
Well, we called the very first episode The Villain. Because I thought that there was an ambiguity there that I wanted to preserve. But one of the reasons that we decided to use the character was because in Britain we have got quite a tradition of making heroes out of criminals or people who, in other centuries might have been regarded as terrorists. So I was deciding to play with that, to take somebody who, in context of the society in which he's existing, would be seen as a villain or a terrorist.
But to you, seen as what? Because he does employ terrorist tactics.
Yes, he does. He seems to me to be a symbol of anarchy, whereas the other characters in the book, the totalitarian state, they are more symbols of fascism, which I tended to see as being the two poles of
but
politics.
But you have described yourself as an anarchist.
Yes.
So in that case, presumably, you veer more towards his view of life.
I certainly do.
But I'm talking about his tactics. I mean, clearly you wouldn't say that people should go out and blow up the Houses of Parliament or the Royal Courts of Justice as he does.
Of course not.
But he uses violence for a purpose. Is that something that you
sympathise
with?
That is something which I don't sympathise with. In fact, in the actual book, I haven't seen the film, but I believe that this wasn't really expanded upon in the film. But in the book, we took a great deal of trouble to actually examine the fact that, all right, this guy is the titular hero of the story. Is it all right for him to kill people just because he's the hero? And I think in book three, it's finally decided that no, it isn't. That killing people is always wrong. And at that point, the initial hero, V, stands down and lets a non-violent person take over the role. So it was an exploration of ideas.
You have said, though, and I guess your tongue was slightly in your cheek, but you have said that if we were to take out all the leaders tomorrow and put them up against a wall and shoot them, and it's a lovely thought, so let me just dwell on that for a moment before I dismiss it, but if we were to do that, society would probably collapse because, as you say, people have become so conditioned to being led. Nonetheless, there is a pointed side to that, isn't there?
Well, yes. I mean, I suppose that coming from Northampton, which during the 17th century, we were pretty much at the centre of the Civil War. And yes, feelings did run high. We tended to support Cromwell. And as a result, we had our castle pulled down when Charles II got to the throne. But it's, I don't think that that is a solution. In those days, yes, it's fun to talk about heads on spikes in the context of the similarities between the current financial situation and the Civil War.
Well, I was going to ask you how you feel about the fact that now, and you were talking about the English Civil War 400 years ago, I'm wondering what you think about now the fact that your man with the mask has been appropriated, this story from 30 years ago has been appropriated now for protesters around the world.
I've got absolutely no problem with the protesters appropriating it because the original V for Vendetta narrative was actually appropriated from me something like 30 years ago by the comic company who published it. I don't actually own that narrative or those characters.
So it irks you slightly that the money that is spent on these masks ends up going to, I think it's Time Warner, isn't it?
It is. I find that more funny than irksome. I like the idea that a corporation like Time Warner should be enabling a big anti-corporate movement like Occupy or like Anonymous.
Do you think it's appropriate, though, that, I mean, your character was fighting in a fascist dystopia? These are people protesting about a financial crisis now or too much surveillance from the government. It doesn't ring absolutely true, does it?
No, I mean, you wouldn't call our current circumstances fascism. You would have to say historically that our current economic circumstances historically seem to lead to fascism. I mean, you've only got to look at sort of Germany during the 20s and 30s. In these kind of conditions, you will tend to get far-right groups being able to scoop up a lot more disenfranchised people who perhaps come to feel that these people represent the only option.
You've also explored sexual politics in a very confrontational way in some of the work you've done. I'm thinking in particular of a book called Lost Girls, which explored the sexual fantasies of three figures from children's literature, Alice, Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, Wendy from Peter Pan. You put them in very sexually explicit scenes in your book. What was your thinking behind this? Were you just trying to shock?
Not at all. No, the original thinking behind Lost Girl was when me and the artist, Melinda Gebbie, who has since become my lovely wife, we were originally thinking that it seemed a bit strange that almost every other subject in the human world is considered fit for writing literature about or creating art around. Whereas sex and sexuality, which is something which concerns all of us, the only genre which talks about it is this fairly despicable, under-the-counter genre that has absolutely no standards.
But these are characters that you plucked out of children's literature. Mm-hmm. I think that is what is some of the shock in this. And also you put them in positions that are incestuous. You show children as young as 14 having sex. So it's not just a celebration of sex. It's also really pushing the boundaries of what is deemed to be acceptable.
Well, this is it. We wanted to do a piece of pornography that was pornography in the traditional sense, but which addressed all of the problems that people have with pornography, particularly the feminist problems.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word pornography, because people do draw a distinction between erotica and pornography, and they say that pornography is something that degrades.
Yes, I was very careful to use the word pornography all the way through the 18 years that it took us to actually complete Lost Girls, because I think that erotica is, it's avoiding the point, isn't it? I mean, erotica means pertaining to love. Most of it, as far as I can see, it's pretty much about sex, isn't it? There's not a great deal of love in erotica. Whereas pornography, that I believe means drawings or writings of wantons, if you like, which seem to be a much more appropriate thing. There's also the class element that sort of, if you can understand the French references or the clever allusions, then you can be reading erotica. But my dad would have had to have been reading pornography.
You're sounding very sort of cool and intellectual about this. I'm sure that some people, though, would have problems about the fact that you were drawing images of children involved in sex or sexual activities.
What we wanted to do was to be as comprehensive about the human sexual imagination as is possible. And I would point out that the word drawing is quite a crucial one there.
So you're withdrawing some of the shot because these aren't photographic images?
These are not real people at all. They are exactly as old as the paper on which they are printed. And one of the points that we wanted to make with Lost Girls was that in cultures where they have a different attitude towards pornography to the attitude which is prevalent over here and in America, I'm talking about places like Denmark and Spain and the Netherlands, they do not see it as in any way a stigma to be reading pornography. It's just accepted as a normal human course of action. In those countries, they have less sex crime, and particularly less sex crime against children, than we do over here, which tends to suggest that in our attitude towards sex and towards pornography, towards writings or drawings about sex, we're kind of keeping the lid on a pressure cooker, which can sometimes explode really dangerously.
So you've attempted to be radical in your work, but you have also been dragged into the mainstream by the fact that film, movie adaptations have been made of your works, of Watchmen, of V for Vendetta. Originally, you were happy to accept the money that brought in. Then what happened?
Well, originally, I was under the illusion that the way that films worked was that you got a lot of option money, and then after a couple of years, they decided that they weren't going to make the film, which was a perfect result. The film didn't get made, you got the money. Then they actually made a couple of my films, and at that point I decided, well, I'll just distance myself from them as much as is possible, because the films have got nothing to do with my books, and because the books themselves were actually written to show off what the comics medium can do that films can't.
Why did you sell the film rights in the first place, then?
Well, in the cases of From Hell and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, this was basically sold on the assumption that the films probably wouldn't get made.
Well, you were trying to get money for Old Rope.
Money for Old Rope.
But you can hardly complain when they do then make the films.
No, well, I can complain about actually how those films turned out. I originally was trying to sort of take the position of, all right, I will not be going to see these films, but I wish them well. Then, when I actually heard about them, I kind of realised that these were absolutely nothing to do with my books.
But just to be clear, you've never seen these films?
Never seen them.
But how can you pass judgment on them?
Well, I do prefer to criticise things from a position of ignorance. But sort of, I've also got a lot of friends who have seen these films and who are familiar with the books. And they assure me that there is only a coincidental resemblance. So at this point, I decided that if in future people were going to be making films of my work, and remember that most of my work I do not own, so I do not have a say in whether these films are made or not. But I decided that in the case of, say, V for Vendetta and Watchmen, that if they were going to be making films of any of those characters, that I would give all of my money to the artists and in return would have my name taken off of the film.
What's the problem with reimagining your work? I mean, you did that with Lost Girls, you did it with A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. You take other people's work, in this case literature, and you rework it for your own edification. What's the problem with Hollywood doing the same for your work?
Well, there's not a problem for anybody other than me. The thing is that...
So it's a personal problem rather than
a... It's a personal problem, and also, I would say that it's a problem of trying to adapt from one medium to another. I believe it very seldom works, and I would also say that the films that I actually enjoy were generally written as films. I'm not really fond of adaption from one media to another in general. In the case of, say, the characters in Lost Girls, in the case of the characters in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, what we're actually talking about is characters that are in the public domain, and that is in a literary area where these authors have been playing with each other's characters for centuries. I believe that what Jules Verne wrote a sequel to Edgar Allan Poe. It's more of a literary game in those circumstances.
But I'm wondering if it's also just a small measure of obsession on your part. I mean, you've said of yourself, if there's a full stop at the end of one of my sentences, that full stop will be there in the finished comic unless something has gone wildly wrong. You like to retain an iron control, don't
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. And it's not done me that bad.
But I'm just wondering if it's slightly precious.
It probably is precious, but there again, given the alternatives in the comics medium to being precious, which is to simply allow all of your art to be altered, your writing to be altered, an editor's whim, when most of the editors in comics, quite frankly, would probably struggle giving you an actual definition of the verb edit.
So presumably you're not delighted at the prospect of DC Comics coming out with prequels to Watchmen?
I suppose, yeah, less than delighted. This is something where originally we were told that we could embark upon Watchmen because they knew that we wanted to own our own stuff, and they had a contract that would enable us to have the rights back when they went out of print. Now, back at that time, there was no such thing as a comic that remained in print for longer than 6 months. So we signed these contracts, obviously without reading them very carefully, because we trusted these people. Then we found out that all of this stuff, no, actually, DC Comics, and they would own all this stuff forever.
You've gone beyond it, though, in terms of just sort of being unhappy about what's happened to your work. You've said that graphic novels themselves may be on the way out. The entire world of comics seems to me on the point of collapse. It's in its death throes. I just hope its final death rattle isn't too humiliating or desperate, because it's deserved. I mean, that's pretty punishing language.
Yes, so I am. I'm obviously in quite a bad mood when I'm saying things like that.
But is that something that
I
you
think
still
it's
think?
Completely merited. Yeah. I mean, I would say that the comics industry, and by that I pretty much mean the American comics industry, which is all that's left these days, effectively. It doesn't seem to have had a new idea in decades. All of the genuine creators that it once had, it alienated them or drove them to embittered retirements and finally death. I mean, you have to remember that with the comics industry, you're talking about something that was set up in the 1920s by American entrepreneurs such as Lex Diamond, Mayo Lansky. It was set up purely as a cover for bootlegging. This is information that's available in a couple of books.
So what could rescue the comics industry now? I mean, are there new subjects, new vistas which it needs to take over?
I think that as with almost any medium at all, the only interesting stuff, from my perspective, that tends to be happening is stuff that is happening upon the margins. And I think that in comics you've got wonderful independent talents that are springing up, people who are self-publishing their own comics. No, they're not in the big spotlight that superhero artists and writers tend to find themselves in these days.
But you've turned your back on graphic novels. I mean, the novel that you're now writing at the moment, I think it's going to be 750,000 words long.
Something like that.
It's a novel. It's not a graphic novel.
Yeah, it's my second novel. My first one, Voice of the Fire, was largely based upon the town and county of Northampton, where I hail
in
from.
In central England.
Yeah.
I don't mean to be rude, but in a way I'm less interested in the subject, but more in the form. Why have you decided to turn your back on graphic novels?
Well,
because... And is it permanent?
Well, I mean, I've not turned my back upon the comics medium. And certainly a number of my works will probably still be coming out in the form that is traditionally known as the graphic novel. I've got no problems with the comics medium at all. I will always love it, and I'm quite good at it.
I'm just wondering if you're growing up.
Well, I'd say that it's not a matter so much of growing up. It's a fact that I can no longer work within the comics industry. This is the gangster ethics that I was just talking about. After seeing great creators go to their graves, cheated and disillusioned.
Strong language, gangster ethics.
Gangster
cheated.
Ethics. And I'm talking about the original gangsters, as I believe the young people like to phrase it these days. The Mayo Lanskys and the Lex Diamonds. The ethics of the comics industry have not changed since those days when they were cheating Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who were two teenagers from Cleveland who created Superman. And National Comics, as I believe they were called at the time, they waited until Siegel and Shuster were going off to fight in the Second World War. And then they told them that, we need to own the characters while you're away, but you'll get them back as soon as you return. These are the ethics that the industry runs on, and they've not changed significantly in 70 years.
Alan Moore, thank you very much for being on Hard Talk.
My pleasure.